You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
I've grown accustomed to her face.
She almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune that she whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me.
Hi, I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 13, My Fair Lady, and with us today is author of that chapter, Peter Felicia. Peter Felicia has written about theater for The Star Ledger, Theater Week, Playbill, Theater Mania, Broadway Select, Encore, and Masterworks Broadway. He's written 6 books on theater, including 3 editions of Let's Put On a Musical. This 4-term president of the Drama Desk Awards serves on its current nominating committee, as well as those for the Lucille Lortel Awards and Theater World Awards, whose ceremony he writes and MCs. He's a National Endowment for the Arts assessor, Cincinnati Conservatory of Music critic in residence, musical theater judge for ASCAP's awards, Broadway radio commentator, and creator for his one-man show, A Personal History of the American Theater. Peter, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I loved your chapter on My Fair Lady, but for listeners who maybe haven't had a chance to read the book yet, could you sort of sum up in your own words why is My Fair Lady included in this book? What makes it a key musical?
Well, of course, a lot of people would say just its great success would be worthy enough to be included in such a book. After all, this was the first musical to run longer than Oklahoma, above 500 performances more than Oklahoma. And that was a big deal at the time. Now, 2,717 performances gets you probably around 30th or 40th place. But back then, that was a run. I mean, after all, the theaters are basically the same size today, but the population has increased and tourists come, so shows run longer. But My Fair Lady was a big deal, and needless to say, it won the Tony Award for Best Musical, and it was the toughest ticket to get in town. But, you know, nobody thought it was going to amount to anything, because first off, Rodgers and Hammerstein tried musicalizing Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw and gave up and said it cannot be done. Lerner and Lowe, who had done Brigadoon, they'd had a hit with that, and a failure with Paint Your Wagon, said, we'll try it. And they tried, and they said, you know, it can't be done. They gave up on it. But finally, they said, you know, let's go back to it and try it again. And so at this point, we're dealing with a show that a lot of people felt was a 2-time loser, so to speak. So nobody expected very much from it. And then they went out and got Rex Harrison to play the lead. Now, the thing was, Rex Harrison, of course, was a fine actor. No question about that. He had won a Tony Award for playing Henry VIII in Anne of the Thousand Days. He was in the movie Blythe Spirit. I mean, everybody liked Rex Harrison in comic roles and in dramatic roles, but could the guy sing? I mean, you never bought an album called Rex Harrison Wishes You a Merry Christmas or Rex Harrison Goes Latin. I mean, you know, those things didn't exist. So as a result, everybody thought, whoa, what's that going to sound like? I mean, a voice like that, are you crazy? Now, the thing is, Rodgers and Hammerstein, ironically enough, did choose him as a possibility to play the King and the King and I a few years earlier. So, I mean, it wasn't so out of the whack that he'd be considered for a musical, but still, to the average person who buys theater tickets, it seemed impossible. But and in fact, he thought that it wasn't going to happen either. There's a very famous story about the fact that in rehearsal, he was doing the songs and felt reasonably comfortable doing them. But then when he first heard the orchestra, he thought, oh, my God, I could never follow the orchestra. It's too loud. I mean, oh, my God. You know, so, you know, that was really, they had to pull him out of his dressing room in New Haven to do the first performance. I mean, he was really, really reluctant to do it. So, so all things are against it, and let alone Julie Andrews, too, who was not that known a quality quantity at this point because she had been the boyfriend, which was a success. Yes. But who was she? So, so nobody thought much of this show coming in. And of course, many times the show that you don't expect to be a success turns out to be the success because people have low expectations. So anyway, there he is. And not only does the show get rave reviews, all critics loved it. It gets all the prizes, all that goes with that. And Rex Harrison wins the award, the Tony Award, and of course, will be one of the first people to win an Oscar for a Tony winning performance as well, but that's down the line. But the point is, My Fair Lady became the biggest selling record of all time. Now, I don't mean in the show category. I mean, in the country category, in the pop category, in the rock category, no album at that time sold more copies than My Fair Lady. So people got used to hearing this voice rasp out. I'm getting raspy myself, I guess, you know, I'm really getting into it. Anyway, rasp out and go on to mesmerize people with these fabulous songs, of these misogynistic songs, to be frank. But, you know, they really, really came to appreciate the fact that the songs were so good and the lyrics were so terrific by Alan J. Lerner, and the melodies are wonderful. I mean, so many songs from My Fair Lady became hits, including I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, which indeed was Rex Harrison's big 11 o'clock number. So, people said, well, you know, maybe we don't need great voices in musicals anymore. Maybe it's not important. Maybe what's really important is to really have a character in a voice. And that maybe is more important. Now, of course, there's no denying that the Broadway musical up till this point, and we're talking, by the way, of 1956, if you look at what happened 10 years before that, you know, you have John Raitt doing the soliloquy in Carousel and you have Alfred Drake in Kiss Me, Kate. You know, these were guys with great voices and
beautiful voices.
Sure, indeed. You know, so but now it's not as important. So as a result, let's start looking at all. And by the way, in the female category, there's Ethel Merman, you know, of course, was very famous for her voice. And Mary Martin had a pleasant voice, too. But anyway, here we are. And now suddenly we're thinking, well, maybe it's a good idea to look at other people who would be interesting in musicals. That might be fun to see other people who you don't expect to be in a musical to be in a musical. It doesn't have to be Enzio Pinza in South Pacific, you know, and he had also done a musical called Fanny, which was a big success, too. So, you know, let's start looking around and see who might be interested in doing a musical. So in the next year, you had Robert Preston. Again, you don't have any albums by Robert Preston in your collection, but there he was. And that was another one where they felt, we can't get anybody else. They offered that part to so many people, Danny Kaye, and nobody wanted to do it. And ironically, some of the people who didn't want to do it would eventually do it on tour. They took the role. But Robert Preston, again, who is he? You know, I mean, as a musical theater person, are you kidding? Tony Randall, who many people know from the series The Odd Couple, you don't expect him to sing, but he was in a musical called O Captain. Not that it was a hit, but he got the role. You know, by the way, a funny thing about Tony Randall, who always used to tell this story, it's not only a case that he couldn't sing well, he obviously couldn't dance well, because the critic for the Herald Tribune said, when Tony Randall dances, he tortures the air. So he always, Maurice Evans, who some people remember as being a warlock on the TV series Bewitched, again, he didn't do much singing on that show, was in a Broadway musical called Tenderloin, which was written by Bach and Harnack, who would later go on to write She Loves Me and Fiddler on the Roof. So Fritz Weaver, another dramatic actor who would win a Tony for a dramatic role, was playing Sherlock Holmes in Baker Street. Again, not a big hit, ran a while, but still the fact is now people are thinking, well, can Sherlock Holmes be in a musical? Would it seem odd if Sherlock Holmes were singing? And whatever the problems were with Baker Street, and there were plenty, the thing was that Fritz Weaver did not look stupid singing as Sherlock Holmes. So the boundaries are expanding, and that was really significant. So that's really a good, again, he only had one song in the musical he did before that called All American, but he, which was written by Strauss and Adams, who had written Bye-Bye Birdie. But the thing was, people were looking out of the box now. And that was kind of exciting. It happened with women, too. Shirley Booth. Now, I mean, you know, Shirley Booth had done a couple of musicals, but in small parts. A small part in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, a starring role in By the Beautiful Sea, I'll grant you. But the thing was, those were musical comedies, and they were specifically out to entertain. And now here comes a musical version of Juno and the Peacock. Now, that's a serious play by Sean O'Casey. Think about it. There's one of the characters in it has lost his arm in a war. I mean, can you picture a person like that singing and dancing? Well, in fact, that character did. But Shirley Booth, who was not known for having a beautiful voice, believe me, and was used to comic effect in By the Beautiful Sea and A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, comic, now is playing a serious role singing. And indeed, she carried it off very well. The reason the show failed is because people weren't interested in seeing a musical version of Juno and the Peacock. It only lasted 2 weeks. Okay. But a recording shows that she really was very, very good in what she was doing. So then you started getting these stunt casting type things from TV stars. You know, there was Jackie Gleason, who was a big TV star at the time, who, again, was not known for his voice, doing Take Me Along, a musical version of Ah Wilderness, a Eugene O'Neill comedy. George Gobel, a name you probably have never heard of, but he was a big TV star. Believe me, a big TV star, was in a musical called Let It Ride, which was a musical version of Three Men on a Horse. Again, it only lasted a couple of months, but he got the part. Sid Caesar, who was an enormous TV star in the 50s for your Show of Shows. I mean, that was a spectacular every Saturday night. I think it might have even sometimes been 2 hours on Saturday night, a 2 hour show. I could be wrong about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if I'm right. So Sid Caesar was in Little Me, which Neil Simon wrote with Cy Coleman and Carolyn Lee. And had he not been in terrible shape emotionally, and he had admitted in his autobiography, he was a terrible drinker at that time, and he was giving terrible performances. But the thing was, you know, when it started out, it got rave reviews. It was just that he wasn't competent to do it night after night after night. But he got the part, and a lot of people liked him at the beginning. Buddy Hackett, a comedian, in a musical called I Had a Ball. Yeah, really, it kept going on and on. What's really funny is when you think of it, Lucille Ball. Now think of I Love Lucy, which you've probably seen, and you probably know that in many episodes there was a big joke of how Lucy Ricardo could not sing.
Right.
That was a big deal, you know. And the thing is, Lucille Ball did not have a pleasant voice. Again, you don't have any albums by Lucille Ball in your collection. And here she was in the musical Wildcat. And a lot of people did feel that her voice wasn't very good, but it was a spirited score, and it would have lasted a long time had Lucy stayed with it. But the idea of doing eight a week and a show that didn't get such good reviews eventually wore on her. And because she was the producer, she put up all $400,000, which is all you needed in those days to do a musical. She said, I'm closing it. But nevertheless, you know, she wanted to do it, and nobody thought, wait a minute, this woman can't sing. No, right this way, your table's waiting, Lucy. We'll take you. We're very glad to have you.
Shelley, and your $400,000.
And your $400,000. You bet. You bet, indeed. You know, and Lucy could afford to lose the money, needless to say. So what's really bizarre, there's a musical called A Family Affair that was written by John Kander. Mm-hmm. Not John Kander and Fred Ebb. That would happen later. This is before Fred Ebb came to see it and said, you know, I could write with this guy. Let me meet him. But at this point, John Kander is writing, ironically enough, with James Goldman, who wrote The Lion in Winter a few years later, and William Goldman, who wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men and won Oscars for them. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, it really, the three of them got together and wrote an original musical called A Family Affair about a marriage, you know, a warring marriage. And here you had Shelley Berman, who was a stand-up comedian. He made albums. He made many albums, but all stand-up comedy. It was he didn't sing. Okay. Eileen Heckert, a wonderful actress who would win an Oscar for Butterflies Are Free some years later, was also in it, but again, not a singer. Morris Karnofsky, a name you probably don't know because he had a big career going in the 40s, but then came The Blacklist and he didn't work for a long time. Mm. But anyway, again, he did like King Lear. I mean, those are the shows that he did, you know, Shakespeare, Shaw, all those things. And here now, here are the three of them in a musical. And I'm telling you, that album is unlistenable. I mean, by the way, in those days, record companies were hot to signed up original cast albums. Even this Tenderloin that I mentioned with Maurice Evans, when it debuted, it was the 14th best-selling album in the country. I don't mean in the show category. There were only 13 records that week that sold better than Tenderloin. And I mean, it wasn't a hit show. People were buying original cast albums, and Columbia was the leader. They were signing up so many of them. They did My Fair Lady. RCA was really jockeying to get in there, too. They were certainly intent on getting as many as they could. They did Brigadoon. Capitol wanted to be in it as well. They did The Music Man. Well, where did A Family Affair wind up with? United Artists Records, which had never done an original cast album before. So this was a show that nobody really believed in. And part of it had to do with the fact, part of it, not all of it, but part of it had to do with the fact that you had these three non-singers. Maybe that was too much to go by, you know, really. Mm. You know, and, you know, one we can take, but three. And ironically enough, there's a song in the show called I'm Worse Than Anybody. It had nothing to do with singing. It had to do with the fact that they were all of the three of them got in each other's way and really caused more problems than they needed to. So, you know, look what happened. The show closed after 2 months. And by the way, what's really significant, all these people I have mentioned, all these people I have mentioned never did another musical on Broadway. All these people who I'm talking about as TV stars now, the people who came from the TV world, they never did another one. Yeah, Shirley Booth did. I mean, she played the nun in Look to the Lilies. But I'm really talking about these TV stars, the Jackie Gleason, George Gobel, Sid Caesar, Buddy Hackett, Lucille Ball, Shelley Berman, never did another musical.
Okay? Do you think that Rex Harrison being in My Fair Lady, do you think having that sort of person who is a serious actor but also a comic actor, do you think that put some sort of respectability on the musical comedy that these people were then able to see themselves in these roles or willing to put themselves in these roles?
Absolutely. Without a question. For one thing, the prestige of a Broadway musical was very, very strong then. Notice what's happened. It's really very interesting when you look at movies of musicals in that era, or even some big movies that we don't really think about today, but like El Cid or Far From the Madding Crowd. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting is they have overtures. They have intermissions. They wanted to make them seem like Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. And that was an important value then. Now, Broadway shows want to seem like movies. they're 90 minutes long. Mm-hmm. There's no intermission. You're in and out. Same type of thing. But the prestige was with Broadway in those days. That was the biggest thing of all. The Hallmark Hall of Fame, which was on TV, used to have adaptations of Broadway plays. That was a very, and those were like event TV things. I mean, the fact that the Hallmark Hall of Fame, notice even the name Hall of Fame. I mean, doesn't that imply importance? And they used to do Broadway shows. So Broadway was really where the prestige was. And that really changed in the late 60s when the baby boomers grew up and were more interested in film and changed the course of things. But yes, I mean, there's no question what you're saying is entirely accurate.
So I'm also fascinated in, you sort of mentioned how popular these original Broadway cast recordings were and how popular specifically My Fair Lady was. Do you, as a critic, as someone familiar with this show, as an audience member, what about that album kind of stirred up people to buy it, to want to keep listening to it?
Well, ironically enough, it ties into what I was just saying about the fact that the prestige was with Broadway. And you seemed, it was very popular with the middle classes to buy these albums because it made them seem very cultured. It made them seem smart. This is where the intelligence was. I mean, the lyrics of My Fair Lady are astonishingly intelligent. You really had to be smart to really appreciate every nuance that were in, especially Henry Higgins songs. I'm an Ordinary Man, A Hymn to Him. Those were songs that really did center on intelligence. You really, the jokes in them were sophisticated. And so, people in that era were not interested in being dumb and dumber. It really was a way of showing that you were of a higher station. I remember going into a person's house in 1957, and on the piano, there was a book of Rodgers and Hammerstein hits. That's the only thing that was on the piano, was on the music stand on the piano. And, you know, and I knew those people until 1977. That book never left that piano. I mean, that, and this was the way of saying, see, we're very cultured people. So that's where it was. In fact, not only were original cast albums big, but it was amazing how many shows also got recordings that were popular recordings. And I don't mean people singing. What I mean is there were many instrumental albums of Broadway scores. There were many instrumental albums of My Fair Lady, Porgy and Bess, got plenty of them. There were instrumental albums of flops like Saratoga, which you've never heard of Whoop Up, which you've never heard of. These are shows that only ran a short period of time, but there were orchestra leaders who used to interpret these shows, or jazz musicians, that happened a lot too, that used to interpret these shows. And these albums went out there, and a lot of people would buy them simply to hear the music to play while they're eating dinner or what have you. But those albums were very popular too. And when the original cast albums started dying down, and in fact, it started happening, they noticed in 1966, because here's what happened in 1966. MAME opened. MAME was a titanic hit. It became one of the longest running shows in Broadway history at the time. All right. But people were noticing that this album on Columbia Records did not sell as well as Flower Drum Song 8 years earlier. In 1958, Flower Drum Song outsold My Fair Lady about 2-1, even though Flower Drum Song outsold MAME 2-1. And yet MAME ran 2.5 times longer than Flower Drum Song did. So people were noticing, the bloom is off the rose. Something is happening here. And what happened, of course, in 1964 were the Beatles, and they changed the course of American music. Now, ironically enough, that same year in 1964, what had happened was Hello, Dolly opened, and that was the number one album in the country, even in the Beatles era. Now I'm talking album. I'm talking about 33 and a third record, which has, you know, a number of songs on each side of the record. Now, number two album in the country that summer, Funny Girl. Those were the two biggest selling albums. Okay. Now, eventually the Beatles albums would overtake that. And indeed, and the reason why is because baby boomers, people born in the late 40s, were now 18 years old, and they were working, and they had money, where they used to buy 45 records, single records, for 98 cents a piece. Now they could afford $3.98, $4.98, $5.98 a record. And so that's where everything turned around, and they were more interested in the new sound. Part of this had to do, as strange as this may sound, part of this had to do with the Kennedy assassination, because the Kennedy assassination took place on November 22nd, 1963. The Beatles released I Want to Hold Your Hand in December of that same year. And by February, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, which really cemented their success. And the point was that we needed something new in this country after the assassination of this young president. The young people in this country loved Kennedy because he was the youngest president ever to be elected, and he seemed young. And again, this was an administration that made very clear that it loved Broadway musicals. You have heard, I'm sure, that it was known as the Camelot years because he liked to listen to Camelot. Supposedly, that's been aggrandized over the years, but that's what the nation was told, that he really loved Broadway. He went to the premiere of Mr. President in Washington, so on and so forth. There was no question that he was well known as a lover of Broadway musicals, and so was Jackie. So suddenly that's extinguished. And suddenly these guys come from England and they have a song called I Want to Hold Your Hand. And even though, believe me, baby boomers were much more, men were much more interested in holding more than hands, the song took off partly because we needed something new and we needed it fast. And that's where everything turned around. So suddenly original cast albums aren't selling as well once the Beatles started taking hold. Hello, Dolly and Funny Girl with the last gasps of greatness. Yes, there would be another big original cast album 4 years later, Hair, but that didn't sound anything like a conventional Broadway musical. Yes, that made it to number one, but again, those sounds had nothing to do with Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe, believe me. And then it took a long time before there were other original cast albums that did very well. I mean, Hamilton certainly did, but that's a long time down the path.
Well, and then when you're mentioning things like Hair, things like Hello Dolly, things like My Fair Lady doing well as albums, immediately coming to mind are all of these covers, like you mentioned, by jazz artists, by pop artists, you know, Nat King Cole having a full My Fair Lady album. Do you think that adds to the popularity of the cast album itself?
Yeah, because it validates it. In fact, I have heard many people say, you know, I heard certain songs from My Fair Lady on the radio sung by these cover artists. I mean, and as a result, I was intrigued. And in those days, believe me, disc jockeys used to say such and such a song from My Fair Lady, such and such a song from Gypsy. They used to do that. Again, it gave it prestige. Rob Marshall, who directed the musical of the movie of Chicago, and his sister Kathleen Marshall, who has directed many, many Broadway musicals, and both of them are terrific choreographers as well, said that when they were growing up, when they would hear a song they liked, they would say, gee, I wonder what that's from. Meaning that they thought it would be immediately from a Broadway show because it was a good song. I mean, certainly songs stepped out of shows. And to be fair to musical theater today, musical theater writing over the years became so specific to character, and some of that has to do with My Fair Lady too, that that's why a lot of those songs cannot be pop songs today. A lot of them can't because they're too specific to the moment. I mean, you're never going to get a pop song of "You Got to Have a Rudder on the Ark" from 2x2, which was a musical about Noah and the Ark. I mean,
what
you
a
know,
bummer! What a bummer!
So, I mean, that's not going to happen. So, as a result, because musical theater writing has been far more detailed in character as time has gone on, you can't take these songs stepping out of the show and make them into pop hits. Not very easily. In fact, I just mentioned Gypsy, and there's a very famous story. Stephen Sondheim was writing the lyrics to Gypsy, and he went first with a song called Small World. And the point is, here's Rose, who has met a man who is not interested in show business, but she wants to get him interested. And she points out all the things they have in common. We have so much in common. It's a phenomenon, is a very great lyric. Anyway, so she says, funny, I'm a woman with children. You're a man who loves children. Well, when Julie Stein got the lyric, the composer, he said, no, don't do this, because therefore you're eliminating an entire sex that can sing this song. We want this song to be popular. So as a result, you know, you can't have I'm a woman with children. No man can sing that. You know, but Sondheim said, yeah, but it's right for the character. And ironically enough, I mean, you know, Julie Stein had many hits before this. High Button Shoes was a hit. Bells Are Ringing was a hit. You know, he really was an established, he had won an Oscar for Three Coins in the Fountain. The fact remained that Sondheim, yes, had done West Side Story. Yes, he had. But the word around town was the fact that Leonard Bernstein had really written a lot of the lyrics about West Side Story, which indeed he did. In fact, I mean, the first poster of that said lyrics by Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim. And Leonard Bernstein said, oh, you know, listen, why don't you just take sole credit? So the thing was that Julie Stein had the power, and yet when they talked to Jerome Robbins, the director choreographer, who really was a big deal and a very hard-nosed guy. Yes, that's how the lyric wound up. And yet they adapted the song for for Johnny Mathis, who had a big hit with Small World, that song. So it worked out for both ways. But the thing was that, yes, there was very much interest in recordings by cover artists. And Julie Stein used to have in his contract with every original cast album, hey, whatever company it was, Columbia Records, For Bells Are Ringing, whatever, which one it was that he signed up with, he said, you must release four of my songs with your stable of singers that make pop records. That okay. is a demand, and that was it has to be. So so a lot of songs did get out because he made that demand in his contract. And so you would often see people who recorded for the same label of the original cast album doing songs from the show. That would happen quite a bit. You may have never heard of Jerry Vale, but anyway, he was a Columbia Records artist, and because he had because they did they were signed to do the cast album of Draft the Cat, he did a song from Draft the Cat. So did Barbara Streisand, but that was another reason. Her husband at the time, Elliot Gould, was in the show, so she decided to record one of the songs. Now in the show, he sang the song. It was called She Touched Me. When she did the song, of course, it was called He Touched Me. And the irony was, as if it wasn't bad enough that Streisand was this rising star and Elliot Gould wasn't at the time, he would have success later, but at the time he was floundering, wouldn't you know that the song he sang, he got to sing on Broadway for a week, and she had this hit song with it, you know, I mean, so no wonder the marriage ended a few years later, 2 years later. So, you know, but that was a big deal. You know, whatever record company signed, you would get a recording, a song, a show that never came to Broadway, closed in Detroit, written by Frank Lesser, though, who had written Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed, called Pleasures and Palaces, was signed again by the aforementioned United Artists Records. And Lena Horne was recording for them then. She made a recording of the title song. So so a lot of that was going on back then, but try to find it now.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, and it's also interesting, a song that you mentioned already from My Fair Lady, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, that when that's being covered by a woman, the pronouns were not always switched.
They usually were, though. Pronouns definitely were taken into consideration. In fact, a lot of people assumed that he touched me was the way it was sung in the show, because why wouldn't it be? You know, I mean, you just assume that female artists looked for the female characters in the show and sang their songs. But yeah, there were some anomalies there. And you know, everybody was very happy just to get the recordings out there. That was just such an important thing. But again, because writing got so specific, it really became a problem. But I mean, here we were with My Fair Lady, with On the Street Where You Live, a song that was almost dropped, by the way. Not sung by Rex Harrison, by the way. But anyway, people didn't know. This guy came on the second act, started singing On the Street Where You Live, and nobody remembered who he was. They'd seen him in a previous scene, but he wasn't the important character in the scene. And so Alan J. Lerner had to write a verse explaining who he was, saying, reminiscing of his meeting Eliza Doolittle. So the verse set up, and they said, oh, that's who that guy is. And then he could sing On the Street Where You Live. But I could have danced all night, even though it has a very strange lyric when she sings, "I'll never know what made it so exciting." She should know. She was able to speak correctly in The Rain in Spain. So, I mean, but that became a hit song too. And in fact, that became the go-to audition song for so many people who are auditioning for musicals. There was a joke of that. There was a play called Say Darling, which was about the making of a musical. And the joke was every actress who came in to audition for the role sang I Could Have Danced All Night. That was the joke because it became the go-to song. That happens occasionally. A song becomes so famous in a Broadway musical that it becomes the song that everybody auditions with. A Corner of the Sky from Pippin is certainly one that was in the 70s, in the 60s, The Impossible Dream. And in recent years, Defying Gravity from Wicked has become the go-to audition song, as well as Astonishing, I think it's called, from Little Women, is one that you hear a lot too in auditions. So so there may not be hit songs anymore, but there are hit songs from the vantage point of people auditioning. They find songs that they like and they do them. So whether they have good voices or not, to get back to what we were originally talking about.
Do you think that we'll move back to a place where songs being written for the Broadway theater can become hits? Or do you think that's a thing of the past that we're not going to see ever again?
Well, historically speaking, pendulums do swing back. And what I've noticed now is something that is analogous to what was happening essentially 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. 100 years ago, musicals were very silly. They thrived on being light, fluffy entertainments with no substance behind them at all. They were called the princess shows. They were the first American shows that really, really made a difference in Broadway, because up until then, there was basically Broadway was importing operettas from Europe. But suddenly, mm-hmm. Jerome Kernan and P.G. Wodehouse and Guy Bolton said, why don't we do American shows with American themes? And they did, and they had a lot of popular songs, but the books weren't good and they were very silly. And so we went through a period where shows were silly. And then Showboat happened, and Showboat was a serious musical. I mean, really, a lot of tough things happened in Showboat. And musicals might have grown up right then and there. That was 1927, December of 27. Think about that, December of 20. The reason I'm making a point of that is because fewer than 2 years later, in October of 29, we had the Depression, and suddenly musicals had to be happy-go-lucky again because these were tough times and people needed an escape. So it wasn't until the 40s with Oklahoma, which had a murder at the end of the show. I mean, what musical has that? That indeed things started getting more serious and musicals became more integrated with the plot and et cetera, et cetera. So things got very serious and musical theater really changed. Well, now things are getting very frivolous again. And what seems to have happened, of course, more than anything else, is that the audience, again, baby boomers have aged into theater goers. They mm-hmm. have the money. And there's been a nice certain effort to get kids involved. Rent was very important in getting kids involved, not just because of the subject matter, not just because the characters were their age, but they did the wonderful thing of allowing the first two rows of the theater to be sold for $20. Mm-hmm. Because up until then, kids used to have to sit in the last rows of the second balcony. That's all they could afford. And it's no fun being way far away. And here they were right up front. So they were treated as first class citizens. Anyway, my point about this is that the baby boomers who grew up with rock music want to hear rock music, and baby boomers are terribly nostalgic. And so as a result, we have these shows where we're jukebox musicals, where indeed what we're hearing more than anything else are songs from the past. And that's good enough mm-hmm. for the baby boomers who want to relive their youth and hear the songs that they grew up with. Whether or not the books are terribly good in between, we'll wait until the next song comes. That's fine. So we have these biographical musicals, and more are coming. I mean, after all, MJ just opened this week and just start picking up the mantle that Ain't Too Proud left, which was about the Temptations. And there's a lot. There was the Cher show about Cher, of course. I wonder how many people went to the Cher show expecting to see Cher. One would expect that, wouldn't you think?
Right, especially if the artist is still alive. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, really. I mean, some people must have been disappointed. No, no reflection on the three ladies who played Cher at various parts of their life. They were terrific. Mm. But anyway, so we are in an era we're back to the princess shows where the books really don't count very much, and people just want the songs. So I do believe, I don't think I'll live to see it, but I do believe perhaps in the 2040s, somebody's going to say, you know, the musical theater needs to grow up, and we're going to get serious shows again, and we're going to get shows that with original scores that are going to be more integrated. And I do think there will be room for hit songs, but you'll live to see it, Andrew. I won't.
Well, so you have a very illustrious past as a critic. So I'd love to know, is there anyone who is starting to do work today that you think you could envision sort of leading that charge in 20 years?
Well, certainly I know names that would mean nothing to you. I do go to a lot of readings, but let's talk about the people who have had a modicum of success, or even more than a modicum. I do believe in Ben Pasek and Justin Paul, who started their career with their Broadway career anyway, with A Christmas Story, which was a musical set in the 30s, and they perfectly got the 30s sound. That was really, so many musicals today that are set in different eras from today still music of today, and it's wrong to have people of past eras have musicals that sound like today's songs, but they adapted very well. Now, since then, they've really concentrated on more contemporary stories, Dogfight, which was a minor success for them, but certainly Dear Evan Hansen, which was a major success for them, still running on Broadway. They certainly showed that they could write with a contemporary sound. But if indeed somebody tomorrow offered them a show that was set in the 40s, and they wanted to do it, I guarantee you that score would sound like a 40 score, because they would work very hard in doing that. But yes, and what's really interesting is Steve Flaherty, who certainly was a product of a later generation. I would imagine, if I had to guess, Steve was now in his 50s at most. The fact remains that when he did Ragtime, set in 1906, it certainly sounded like that era, and he got the Ragtime sound beautifully. So I would like to see more musicals with original scores. More than what we have now. That's me, if I may cast my three electoral votes. That's what I would like to hear. It was very exciting going into a theater and hearing songs you never heard before and coming out and saying, wow, I love that song, whatever it might be. So as opposed to going in knowing the songs already. I mean, what's really interesting to me is that two shows this year that had, not quite this year, but recent shows, let's put it that way, but shows that were still running this season and have closed, one permanently, one maybe permanently, I had wonderful books. And I'm talking about Jagged Little Pill and Girl from the North Country, both of which the writing in the books were terrific. I mean, you really got involved in the characters in those stories. You really cared about them. So even though the songs basically were written beforehand and had to be adapted to the book writer had to adapt those songs into the story, and often had to make situations involving the story that indeed wouldn't have happened if the song hadn't been written in advance. The book writers did excellent jobs in fitting them in and making them sound as if they were really written for the shows, that they weren't taken from albums here and there. No, they really made them sound as if the book was written and the songwriters looked at the book and said, oh, a good song would go here. Let me write it. So the writing of books, I think on the basis of those two, may very well be an indication that we're going to have very strong jukebox musicals as time goes on because of the book writers, because more people, well, let's face it, so many playwrights want to have a musical success because there's much more money in musicals.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's very interesting. If you looked at the top running, let's go back to the early 80s. Okay, if we go back to the early 80s and we look at the top 10 musicals at that time, the longest running musical was Grease. Grease is probably now in 15th place. Okay, so many musicals have run longer than Grease. If we go back to the early 80s and we look at the top 10 longest running plays, all right, that's 40 years ago now. And you look at the list of the top 10 longest running plays now, 40 years later. What's changed? Nothing.
Wow.
Nothing. No play has cracked the top 10 in 40 years. So the thing is, musicals are where the money is. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, even playwrights want to write musicals. People who never even thought about writing a musical, who consider themselves playwrights and would only write serious plays, when people come to Lynn Nottage and say, do you want to write a musical about Michael Jackson? She says yes, mm-hmm. even though her hands are tied because she can't really deal with so much of what we know about Michael Jackson. The fact is, she did the best she could. You watch the show and you say, you know, there's another way that Michael Jackson singing I'm Bad could really be used in a very different context, because he was bad, we're led to believe by many people, even though, let's face it, he was exonerated in court. But nevertheless, so Lynn Nottage had her hands tied because the producers of the show, some of them are people who involved with Michael Jackson's estate, and they said, here's what we want. But still, you know, there's the money. You know, I mean, yes, Lynn Nottage's plays have been extraordinarily well received. And two Pulitzer Prizes, how bad can they be? The fact remains, why aren't they in the top 10 of the longest running plays?
Right.
You know, because plays just don't run that long. They just don't. It's very rare for a play to run even 500 performances now. Very rare. And notice how many plays are done by institutional companies like Manhattan Theater Club or Second Stage, where there are limited runs. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 months, 3 months, maybe, you know, so a lot of plays start out. It's not like the old days when plays opened and hoped they would run forever. Now they only run a short period of time. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people want to a lot of stars want to do Broadway plays. You know, I'll do it for 2 months. I'll take the financial loss and maybe I'll win a Tony. I truly believe the word EGOT. You know, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony is one of the reasons why people come to Broadway. You know, they think, oh, let me do that. That's a big challenge. Let me win all four awards. Let me do that. But to win the Tony, you have to do it. You have to come here to Broadway and you have to learn the part and you have to do it. But if you do it for a couple of months, you might get away with it. You might get a Tony and you don't have to come to Broadway ever again. And I do believe a lot of people who don't win that Tony the first time around, such as Tom Hanks, who was in a play, got a nomination, was damn mm-hmm. good, no question, but didn't win. You know, I have a feeling we're not going to see him again. I think he was going to say, I took my shot. That's fine. Do I really need an EGOT? I mean, you know, a lot of these people who don't have an EGOT have an ego, and that's good enough, you know. Mm. And, you know, they've certainly been rewarded in many ways, and that's perfectly fine.
Take a page from Whoopi's book. Just be a producer and get Best Musical, right?
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Lord knows that she's done her time on stage, but again, in limited engagements, you know, even when mm-hmm. she took over and Funny Thing Happened the Way of the Forum, you know, it was only for a limited time. So, and again, you know, to a lot of them, it's maybe to say it's a goof is not really fair, because that makes it sound not serious, but you know, it's a change of pace. Let's put it that way for some people. So yeah, they'll do it for a couple of months and let's live in New York, you know, let's go to these nice restaurants, you know, it's a fun place to live. So why not? Woody Allen, when he was he wrote a play, Play It Again, Sam, in 1969, and he was in it. Hmm. And he said this was his perception. I'm not saying it's everybody's perception, but his perception was that this is the easiest job in the world. I just show up 8 times a week for a couple of hours. I have, aside from Wednesdays and Saturdays, I have every day to myself all day long. You know, I know the show because I wrote it. You know, it's the easiest job in the world. Now, some people feel it's the hardest job in the world, and they have a point too, because doing the same thing night after night after night after night is very hard for some people. Mm. You know, I mean, some people, I'm not going to give names, but I have gone to see people at the beginning of the runs who were terrific, and I've gone to see them at the end of the run, and they're improvising like crazy. They're trying new things, to give them credit. They're trying to do it a different way, but the different way is an inferior way to the first way they did it. I don't know if you remember when you were in college, in high school, they used to say when you took the SATs, Chances are the first answer you're inclined to give is the best answer, is the right answer. Well, similarly speaking, these performers who do shows, their first instincts and the director's instincts are the best ones. The choices they make later are often not as good. I've seen that happen time and time and time again with people whose names you know very, very well and you respect. But I'm telling you, seeing these people at the end of the run, because they're just so bored by doing it night after night after night after night after night after night that they have to do something different with their lives.
Well, it's, and that's something that plagued the original production of Pygmalion, with sort of this nebulous ending that is different from My Fair Lady, that actors playing Professor Higgins would kind of go out on a limb and say, I'm just going to give the audience what they want. I'm going to give her a bouquet of flowers. I'm going to end things well with Eliza. Do you have an opinion on the way the ending of My Fair Lady kind of is not as open-ended?
Well, sure. There's no question that in the original production, yes, Eliza comes back. And yes, Henry Higgins is not going to change who he is. And he asks her to get the slippers. Mm-hmm. And as the stage direction indicates, she understands. That's literally in the stage direction. She understands. And so we really have a situation where the guy is going to have the marriage, if there is a marriage, and chances are we're led to believe there is, on his terms. Now, Shaw did end the play in a nebulous fashion too, but he then wrote an essay sometime later saying that Eliza married Freddie. She did not marry Henry Higgins. So that's apparently what he believed, or at least what he wanted. Well, when Al J. Lerner wrote the show, he actually wrote a little, not quite an essay. It's only a few sentences, but he says, Shaw, forgive me, but I don't think you're right. I think that she does wind up with Henry Higgins. Yes, I there was a production in England with Jonathan Pryce, where at the end of the show, they both ran into each other's arms, which was really quite nice. I think there should be a happy ending. And I think what My Fair Lady should say is, even if you are a low-class person, education can make you a worthy person enough to be with a high-toned person, a learned person who was from a different class to begin with. Again, class is such a big thing in London. Class distinctions are very, very important. There certainly were, I don't know about right now, I don't live there after all, but certainly in the 50s, that was still an issue back then. And so as a result, the idea of marrying a commoner seemed to be anathema to so many people, which is why that ending was left to a theater goer's own interpretation. But yeah, I'd like to think that certainly people who can be educated should be worthy of people who had been educated already. Why not? I mean, especially that's a very American interpretation, because after all, we are in a country that ostensibly believes that all people are created equal. So if they are, well, then everybody's worthy of everybody. And so let's reflect that. So I like My Fair Lady that implies that they're going to get together and live happily ever after. I don't know if they will. I don't know if anybody will in musicals. I mean, you know, I don't think Sky Masterson, Guys and Dolls is going to be happy beating a drum for The Mission very much longer. But I don't think it's always amazing to me in South Pacific, at the end of the first act, when those two kids run in and she finds out that he has two children, that she doesn't say to him, you know, Emil, before you asked me to marry you, you could have told me I'm going to be the stepmother of two kids. You know,
right.
I mean, that's a very different value system. You know, I mean, being married to a man with no children, being married to a man with two children. I'm not talking about race at all. I'm just talking about two kids. That's a lot of work. I mean, so so while I can hope that Eliza and Henry would live happily ever after, it's not impossible that he would pull rank on her as time whenever she did something wrong and point it out to her.
Well, it is. It's complicated because class aside, their relationship has started as teacher pupil.
Yeah.
So, you know, are they going to be able to get out of that?
Yes, even though Anna in The King of Siam tells us by your pupils you'll be taught, and to a degree right. she has taught him, the mm-hmm. fact remains that it's much easier for him to pull rank and for, you know, we mm-hmm. so many of us never get over who we were. It's one of our great curses in life. I mean, every psychiatrist will tell you a person's childhood is so definitive in what that person becomes, and so many people just can't get over it, and they go back to who they were as children emotionally and intellectually even. So when he pulls rank on her, she's going to remember that she was this flower girl with it's even established she has bad teeth. That's even in the stage mm. directions. She could use the service of a dentist, I think the expression in the stage direction goes. But still, while we're actually sitting in the theater, we'd like to believe that these two could have a relationship and live happily ever after.
Mm. And I mean, let's talk about what's not in Shaw's stage directions. You know, he's got a novel worth every time you turn the page. It's like, and here's what's actually going on behind the scenes. Do you think that intricate subtext, that those intricate commentaries on society, do you think those carried over well to Lerman Lowe's musical adaptation?
The irony is that My Fair Lady is not so much a musical of Shaw's Pygmalion as it is of the 1938 movie of Pygmalion. Mm. That really was the great influence, because in Shaw's Pygmalion, you do not go to the Ascot. You do not go to right. the ball. But in the movie, you do. One has to wonder, when Rodgers and Hammerstein were trying it, and I heard Richard Rodgers say, we were convinced it couldn't be done. And you don't mean to tell you that it could. You know, you don't need me to tell you that it could be done, because they did it. But it's funny, there's a song called You Did It in the Show, and they did do it. But one has to wonder if they were just reading the play and never bothered to screen the movie. I mean, obviously, screening movies in those days was far more arduous. I mean, now, you know, we pop in a DVD, we stream it, you know, fine. You know, do you want to do the show? Well, in 2 hours, you'll have your answer. But back then, I don't know. I mean, one would think that Rodgers and Hammerstein, especially in the 50s, were out of five musicals, four were wild hits. One would think, and really, what's really interesting, as of 1954 or so, the top five musicals in terms of length of run, four of them were Rodgers and Hammerstein. The only one that wasn't was Annie Get Your Gun by Irving Berlin. But the other four, you know, Oklahoma and King and I and South Pacific, I should say three out of four, were the longest running musicals in Broadway history. So you would think that they would have the power to get this movie. And for all I know, they saw the movie. I've never heard one way or the other whether they did or didn't. Mm. But gee, I would think that, you know, Oscar Hammerstein, who did such a fabulous job of adapting the movie of Anna and the King of Siam. I mean, it's much more, King and I is much more based on that movie from 1946 than it is on Margaret Langdon's memoir or novel or whatever it is. I mean,
or whatever it is. We'll leave
whatever
it
is. Yeah, I mean, you know, boy, I'm telling you, you know, there are so many stories about Anna, the real Anna, that have nothing to do with that woman. Nevertheless, so since he saw the movie of Anna and the King of Siam, didn't you see the movie of Pygmalion? It's just amazing that they wouldn't see what Lerner and Lowe saw, especially Lerner, the wordsmith, of going to the ball and going to the races. Very important scenes, you know. So I think it had much more to do with that than anything else, the movie.
And do you think, just because you've mentioned movies, do you think in hindsight, would you have liked to have seen Julie Andrews do the movie, or are you happy that we have the performance by Audrey Hepburn dubbed by Marnie Nixon?
Well, almost across the board, I would rather see the person who did the Broadway show do it, because I wanted that. I would like that performance captured forever. Mm-hmm. After all, it doesn't take long for people to age or as I say before, change the role and in what they're portraying. So I'm very grateful to have Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees. That's really quite wonderful to have her doing it. So yes, I would have preferred Julie Andrews in My Fair Lady than Audrey Hepburn, who was fine. But, you know, also, when she starts singing The Rain in Spain and she's not singing The Rain in Spain because Marnie Nixon is, the difference in the voices is so enormously obvious that it takes you out of the situation. And so many musical movies where they dubbed people, it's, you can really tell it's not the same person who you just heard speaking. So I'm always for the original person doing it. And, you know, this must be very hard on Cheetah Rivera, who after all was the original Anita in West Side Story and was also the original Velma in Chicago. Why is this really hard for her? Not just because she lost the part, but the two people who got the part won Oscars. You know, Rita Moreno in West Side Story and Catherine Zeta-Jones in Chicago. They got Oscars. Well, you know, Cheetah Rivera, certainly who originated those roles, after all, you know, could have gotten Oscars too. Now, granted, the Chicago movie was more than a quarter century later after the original production. So we'll let her up, we'll let Hollywood off the hook for that one. But after all, I mean, the movie of West Side Story was only 4 years after the original Broadway production. So she still could have done it, you know.
Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been the end of the world. And, you know, I really don't know who's older, Rita Moreno or Cheetah Rivera, but I don't think there's, in fact, I think Rita Moreno's older. So, I mean, the fact is having a younger Anita, not by much, maybe a year or two, wouldn't have been an issue. So it's really too bad that that's the way it played out. But it must be very painful for Cheetah Rivera to look at those two situations and say, wow, I'm the one who blazed the trail there.
Right.
And look what happened. So, yeah, I'm always for the original one. Unless the person really got bad reviews. I mean, for example, Jill Hoth, H-A-W-O-R-T, was the original leading lady of Cabaret. And this is a very controversial performance on stage. A lot of people thought she was wonderful. I thought she stunk. But so as a result, yeah, give me Liza Minnelli for the movie.
And of course.
You know, and the thing is, when Cabaret was reviewed by Walter Kerr in The Times, he said, Cabaret is a brilliant musical. A stunning musical, brilliantly conceived, with one wild wrong note. And what he meant was that leading lady. And he went on to castigate her as time went on in the review. Mm. But, you know, I mean, but some people will say, oh, she was brilliant. She was, but I'm very glad that Liza Minnelli did the role because I thought, you know, so the answer obviously is if I didn't like the performer on the stage show, yeah, give me somebody from the movies. But if I thought the stage person was terrific, let's see that person in the movies.
Mm. All right, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
Listeners, please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about My Fair Lady, please also review the links in the below description. I am Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast. Staunchly, never budge.
Just a most forgiving man. But I shall never take her back. If she were crawling on her knees, let her promise to atone, let her shiver, let her moan. I'll slam the door and let the hellcat freeze.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.